And we owe you guys, well, I guess if you're listening live, maybe you don't care, but we do owe other people that can't listen podcasts, but we're coming. They're coming. They're coming. I see Jesse fervently messing with the board, trying to, you know, wiggling wires and doing things. Oh, yeah, yeah, right. Thanks, Fahim. Somebody. Yeah, because, yeah, I might as well say that it is my birthday.
Yeah, happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
Shut up, you know.
Is that April Fool's Day or no?
Yeah, it is indeed. But I was reminded because I forgot to launch the recording. By the way, if you don't mind, look that it's at level 20% or 25%, so it's not distorted completely on the recording computer.
Okay.
I would check myself, but I guess I'm talking on the radio. I'm not that senile yet. Because well, we had that problem where somebody, I don't know, like, twisted it all the way up and the recording was completely
distorted, right.
And Jesse had to spend his weekend applying fancy filters or God knows what, though he did it. And it was an important show too. So, there we are. Right, you see, I mean, it has to be about 20 or no more than 25, otherwise it's totally distorted.
25.
You know, you good with that? You see it?
Everything good?
25.
That's the one button I know to operate on Audacity.
Awesome. So as the Middle East blows up and burns out, I just want to say, hey, Saudi Arabia, thanks for listening to Punkonomics. You listened to what I had to say. I know Cheyenne and I were going back and forth, but you guys decided to jump in the mix. And whether it's right or wrong, I don't know, but at least you're sharing the cost. So I don't feel bad about being unemployed and not having my...
They've been selling weapons, gas and stuff like that to Assad, to anybody who's not Iran or Shia, basically. ISIS.
But you know what's really
our
interesting?
Our allies. Oh, wait a minute.
Right.
It's so confusing, yes. Right? I mean, ISIS are our allies now against Iran. Or are we now becoming friends with Iran because they are the ones who are really the only ones fighting ISIS?
That's what I don't understand. On one side, you know, we're supposed to hate the Iranians. On the other side, we're using them for something else in Yemen, right?
Right.
You understand what's going on there.
Right.
So, tell us what's going on.
You know, the ISIS, the whole ISIS thing, which just appeared, you know, in the last 2 years, because it was not there before.
It evolved out something else.
Yeah, and how did it happen? It was after the Iraqi military was not able to contain their attacks against Iraqi villages. And at that time, Nouri al-Maliki, the Prime Minister of Iraq, was, you know, he was very, very close to the mullahs in Iran. And
to the Bush administration.
Right.
Right.
And what he was trying
again,
to do...
Once again, a strange bedfellow.
But he saw the money.
Yeah. Took down the Iraqi military, and then he suggested as, hey, let's get volunteers to fight ISIS, these group of guys.
Mm-hmm.
So he created that fear actually to win the elections, but unfortunately he did not. But now that's what
that's considered an accomplishment in some sense, at least Democrats say that, because of course Nouri al-Maliki was a horrific dictator. I mean, the tragedy that within a few days of the quote-unquote liberation of Iraq, the torture and the horror went to levels that Saddam Hussein himself could never achieve.
Right.
And I'm not even being over the top joking here. Yeah?
Right, right.
So the Sunnis, who are the dominant minority in Iraq, who are the majority in Iran.
In the whole world.
were in charge of Iraq, and they were behaving rather disgustingly towards the Ba'athists, the Sunnis, Saddam's people.
Right, right.
Who are now getting tortured horribly and massacred, and etc. And they eventually arose another core of the Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which eventually... Al-Qaeda in Iraq, I guess, here's a definition, a working definition in this Alice in Wonderland kind of geopolitical framework here. That when Al-Qaeda comes out of discussion with my kids, actually, with Felix this morning, so Al-Qaeda was a kind of a loose, the danger of it too was this loose network, not associated, have no real bases, right? I mean, it's just anybody can be Al-Qaeda if they want to, you know, perform terrorist attacks against Western and American interests. But once we invaded Iraq, and ironically, the neoconservatives, Bush, Cheney and company, basically took Iraq and delivered it on a silver platter to the mullahs of Iran. And that was no surprise, by the way. Anybody who knew what the bleep they were talking about, including little old me, were saying that already in 2003 before the invasion. Say, you realize you're going to do that. It's
right,
a lot
right.
of
and it's not like they did it just to serve them. They needed an ally in the region that knows, that helps them out in the region.
Yeah.
And most of the countries around, they were not, they were against the invasion of Iraq. So they were not helping. They're like, you know what?
Yeah,
but
you know,
telling you not to go there.
Suffer from setting this region on fire.
Yes,
but
so
you know, that's the pattern that the U.S. has had as far as relationships over there. Because if you even want to get, hey Talia, Talia Balak is here in the house. Hey Talia. Oops. So anyway, that seems to be the pattern as far as U.S. relations are with the Middle East, because you can go as far as Karzai, Afghanistan, mm-hmm. who, by the way, his brother is the biggest heroin dealer in the whole area.
Good business.
You know, and he basically just kind of supported his own brother, and we supported him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
right.
it's kind of like it doesn't matter who gets in there. For the most part, they're all corrupt. You know, and their oppressors.
Serving their own interests.
Yeah.
Follow
so,
the money.
But so Al-Qaeda, right? We had Al-Qaeda, which essentially, I mean, obviously we inflated it just like the Soviets, you know. Didn't I say on the show a couple of times?
The Soviets,
ago,
Ebola, you
I
know.
I learned under a guy who was, his job, he made his career out of creating studies that showed that the Soviets were way more scary than they really ever were, and was paid by the CIA to do that. It was kind of funny to study under him because, you know, you can imagine the inside jokes that he was able to come up with. But anyway, the thing is that now with the situation, it's no longer hidden. Now it's troops on the ground, well armed with American weapons, sold not directly perhaps through Saudi Arabia and maybe other Gulf states, but where do they get their weapons, these guys? Because so they're no longer this loose kind of terrorist global organization. Now they're troops on the ground, and this is essentially the difference. This is the story of how that loose group known as Al-Qaeda turned into this significant power on the ground,
mm-hmm.
known as ISIS. They're no longer hiding.
Right. You know what's funny? If you go to Yemen's case, you have Al-Qaeda fighting against the Houthis, which are the Shia minorities that are supported by Iranians, and also allied with the past president, the Yemeni's past president. So you've got Al-Qaeda fighting against, you know, the government of Yemen and the old the Houthi movement over there, and you know, it's all crammed
which Jen
together.
Saki, that's a Jen Psaki is a verb in Russian now. The spokesperson, the lady who's spokesperson for the Pentagon, because she's like the person who says the most like ludicrous things that recently even the American press corps couldn't break but into giggles, literally on live, because she said that as a matter of policy, America never interferes in the internal affairs of other countries.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So everybody was even the journalists that were too polite because well they know who they work for didn't even say much. They still couldn't help but giggle.
Right.
But anyway, she was also talking about how well we're in support of the legitimate government
of Yemen.
Of Yemen, which is legitimate. I mean, if you're appointed by external power, yeah, you call it legitimate. I mean, same like they say today that the Ukrainian, whatever you think about Putin, you know, there's no democratically elected government in Kiev. You know, there was a fabricated election, kind of like the Soviets used to do. With only one party.
You know, that's true, but then if you look at the Yemenis case, you know, you've got the Arab Spring coming, right? And then a bunch of countries going down, new leaderships are taking over, and then the Yemenis also were protesting and having the same issues. So they got the GCC's new initiative of, you know, here the president would resign and his VP would take over. And they got, you know, here, you guys can talk and fix everything together. Mm-hmm. But then, you've got the Houthis, very supportive, mm-hmm. sort of, supported from Iran. Sort of the same thing in Hezbollah in Lebanon.
Because they're Shia. Again,
yeah.
You have to, I mean, for people who really...
Right.
Well, by now, Americans, I think, know Shia-Sunni thing. But
exactly.
It's an old split. It's like Catholics and Protestants, a little bit.
Exactly, yeah. And then you've got everything. But what's really interesting is that the United States, a couple of weeks before everything got crazy in Yemen...
Mm-hmm.
Withdrew all their military and even left their weapons and some airplanes and some very secret, you know, intelligence that they had, just left it out there and disappeared. Now, if you look at it, what is going on? You know, and then you got these Saudis at later taking care of that. Now, all these files, there have been reports that all of them were shipped to Iran, and the weapons, the Houthis took them, you know, and they took the Yemeni's military, sort of like the same ISIS thing in Iraq. Yeah. They took all the weapons.
Only faster.
That was owned by the military. That's actually bought from the United States, you know, so this military couldn't even protect its own equipment.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting move. Why would the United States know that it's so dangerous and not take everything with them?
It's sometimes, well, it might be expensive. It's one of the things that when you deploy like this, you know, across the planet, it's very difficult to, you know,
I mean, it doesn't hurt you.
Some of the older people remember, and you've probably seen it, despite not being born, probably, you know, how the Vietnam War ended, you know, that scrambling onto that helicopter on the
roof. Oh, right. That was the same.
Right.
Yeah, you know, so now nobody scrambled. I know, yeah, yes, hello, my Democrat with a capital D friend, you know, I know, yeah, Obama got us out of Iraq and Afghanistan, didn't he? Yeah. That remind me, I can make some dirty jokes about pregnancy here, you know, about like getting us out in time or what that's exactly.
Oh my God, you know, there's some really hardcore Obama haters out there. Did you see that post that I put on Facebook?
But you have to hate your president for the right reason.
Right.
That's important. A lot of people out there hate him for awful reasons.
Did you see that chart that I put in on Facebook where it kind of compared the economy compared to the previous economy with Bush? Somebody put a notice that I hope he chokes on the chicken bone. I'm going like, whoa, that's pretty hardcore.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's difficult to criticize him in that sense, I know, especially if you're white like I am.
Mm-hmm.
Because, right, immediately you're bundled along with the overwhelmingly disgusting, I mean, I cannot say the words that come to my mind to describe the criticism of the president from the right. The inherent, the deep racism in America, the, I mean, shameless in the most, I mean, yeah, I cannot find words that do not involve, you know, serious vulgarities and, to describe that. So when you criticize him from the point of view of, from the point of not having delivered what he promised, not having not sufficiently progressive, that Americans vote for a progressive president and get a Reagan, you know, then that's the criticism that's difficult to do when you're white, because you have to always kind of remind them, no, wait a minute, no, don't lump him with all this new Klansmen. And,
you know, right.
I put it to that it's up to right-wingers, Republicans, even libertarians, to clean up their act, because right now they look like the Klans party.
Yeah, especially in Indiana.
And Indiana, indeed. Yeah, this is really something else what's going on here. I mean, talk about the Christian Taliban, yeah?
You know, it's really amusing how all of a sudden, when they saw themselves they're going to lose money in the state, you know, all these companies and states saying, okay, we're going to cut off funds and we're not going to go to Indiana. Now they're changing their tunes.
You got to hit them where it hurts.
Hit them in the money. Yeah.
Hit them in the money.
Well, at the same time, Arkansas is just doing the same thing as Indiana did. So, I mean, you know, this is a cultural war in a sense. It's part of that cracking of society that's going on. I mean, the things are not well. So yeah, you can say, oh yeah, there's a little bit more jobs after all. Stop your whining. Yeah, okay, fine, right? I mean, some things are not, it's not all bleak, all free fall.
Right.
But they are very significant, very disturbing, and I do think kind of epochal, you know, that we're running out of steam fundamentally. There is need for real change.
Right.
Yeah. In order to continue hating on the president a little bit. Yeah,
right, exactly.
Remember what you were voted to do? I don't see any. Yeah. but that's an important aspect.
Right.
Because he requires, criticism. In fact, it's healthy for him.
Mm-hmm.
His only real excuse, as far as I'm concerned, is, you know, we wanted to have an FDR, right?
Right.
And we didn't get one. And in a sense, the strong defense for Obama's presidency, and again, it's nothing personal. I don't care. I have nothing personal against George W. Bush, you know? Well.
I do.
Maybe, you know. Yeah. As a president, he was awful, you know? Sadly, the same goes for President Obama, his presidency. But you see, FDR had support. I mean, Wall Street.
Right.
Not only did they land on him, of course, they couldn't use racism against him because he was old money, you know, northeast, a little bit like Bush, despite his successful, you know, portrayal of himself as a lovable redneck. He's about the least, maybe lovable, but certainly not a redneck.
Right.
And but FDR had you know, highly mobile workforce, you know, labor movements and politics and less propaganda, so he had popular support despite having very abortive, it never went far, but literally an attempted coup, like military coup, to take him out. That hasn't happened to Obama, at least that we know of.
Right.
It's mostly rhetoric.
The NSA's got his back.
You think? Probably. Well, maybe that, you know, yeah, I mean, I can see that, you know. Just one other excuse that I don't like, I mean, people would say, like, yeah, but they say, cut the man some slack. I mean, if Obama even attempted to do what he promised, he'd be dead three months since his inauguration, by, you know.
But
that's another defense of his. I
agree with you. I mean, if the American public just concentrated on the facts and just portrayed their disgust with the presidency that way, then they probably would yield more positive results instead of all this worthless hate. I mean, and I want to direct that commentary to some of the people that have been posting other stuff on my Facebook page, at that fact sheet that I put up there. You know, just put something up positive instead of just saying, oh, let's hope he chokes on a chicken bone or something like
that. Yeah, that's kind of...
I mean, that's ridiculous.
Whatever, you know, I mean, I'm open-minded.
I saw that.
I mean, it's like, do they think that that's not already on the internet? I mean,
right.
Do we need to increase the supply of that?
And just remember that, you know, NSA looks at all that and they go, ooh, a threat, you know? So, keep it clean.
I mean, I think they're not as that stupid. Though, to go back to where Fahim started us today, when you look at foreign policy in the Middle East, you kind of wonder, what's going on? Is this a mental deficiency? Profound stupidity?
Did you see John Stewart's remarks?
No.
John Stewart had a fantastic statement that we're fighting, how does this go? We're fighting ISIS along with Iran, right? But then we're fighting against an Iranian-backed movement in Yemen. So even though it's decades.
Along with ISIS.
It took decades, but we were finally fighting a proxy war with ourselves.
Oh, yes.
Oh, and then you're negotiating as well. And
we're fighting a proxy war with ourselves. Yep. It took decades.
I mean, what is this, right? I mean, is this purely like, I mean, the only reasonable, if you're trying to think, if it's not a carnival of idiots with lots of power, a complete carnival of idiots, how can that, I mean, at least their assistants would come and say, yo, give him a shot, something, vitamins, something to maybe kickstart the brain, you know what? I see the politicians being caught in having to repeat. Is it truly money set the world on fire, short term? Is it the military industrial complex selling to both sides? Is this what's driving this? I mean, I know they do, but do they have that much power to trump everything?
I would say there's certainly not one. I don't think you could ever pin it down to one force. Yeah. I mean, you know, the conspiracy theory guys like to go in the back rooms and say, this is it.
Right,
it's this combo of, you know, bankers. That's not it. But I mean, I'm sure military industrial complex, there is a lot of money. Mm. More so than the money, though, there's a lot of power. It's been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a network of people in the right places. And, you know, you can't discount that. Mm. So, I mean, there's influence there. I mean, hell, look at it.
But even for
Yemen, you know, I can't even keep track of the names. Who are we bombing in Yemen again? What's the name?
Houthis,
yeah, okay. Well, we, like, you know, a couple months ago, we mysteriously lost a bunch of U.S. military equipment.
Even for me, you know, it's difficult for me to say. I mean, even with the interest, monetary interest, all these apparatchiks, I mean, it's like jokes. It reminds me again, once again, of Soviet Union jokes, you know, the people living under the boot of the Soviet Union were making jokes about how stupid these apparatchiks were.
Right.
Powerful, mean, and stupid. And once again, I see this scary parallel between stories from my granddad about East Europe to what I'm living here in America in the 21st century. It's really scary. But, you know, I can't wrap my mind that it's that stupid. I mean, even the military industrial complex would like to get some kind of, not like, you know, set the world on fire and see what happens.
Yeah.
You know, anybody want to buy some jets? You know?
Well, if you think about the money, If you think about the money, you just said it. They left their equipment over there, and now they're hitting it again. But it's not the United States that's hitting it. Mm. The intelligence they just provided to the coalition, the Saudis and the Gulf states and some of the Arabs.
The Saudis are excellent customers.
And yeah, exactly. So they're actually, the Saudis will be paying for it. So instead of the American people paying for a war, it's just the Saudis are paying for it.
And I guess Democrats immediately latch onto that. By the way, I have some Democrat friends that do. I've seen them do it. Seen them do it on Facebook and such. You know, they latch on that. Like a leech. And look, you see, Obama is smart. You know? Mm-hmm. Unlike Bush, he doesn't commit 100,000 soldiers. He just plays proxy war. Proxy war, that's clever. That's clever. Obama, clever.
Bush did it. Bush is clever, too. The second Gulf War as well. The Saudis paid for it as well. You know, Bush was smart, too.
But, there was this notion of going from neocolonialism to, downgrading from, Windows 8 to Windows 95. You know what I mean? Going to direct colonialism where you have troops on the ground, which is generally not as effective if your goal is, global empire, the neocolonial proxies in charge.
Yeah,
it's not going very well. I mean, I do not see this in any conceivable way, even for the long-term investment portfolio of the security, in the long run, is this the long run?
I don't know. You got to ask where they're going to, if they don't get to operate in the Middle East, where else do they get to operate right now?
Exactly, the last 100 years it was.
I mean, no matter how much you stir the leaves in South America, it never gets out of control.
No, you can make yourself look like a complete idiot, and indeed they manage, like this whole Venezuela being a. Remember that scene when Jen Psaki? Right, I told you, right? In Russia, they use it as they're like comedy TV show. They use her name as a verb for being like ridiculous now. And anyway, this whole Venezuela being a security threat for America, and the journalists in America were giggling
C-SPAN
because it was like, excuse me?
It's just a cycle,
But you can't do they have Colombia, though even Colombia is a little bit pushing back now because they don't want to end up like Mexico, and they're on their way. Not that they're afraid the government there to kill hundreds of people every week, but they consider that in the long run, again, this will be chaos and civil war. You have, who else is there? Honduras, no? Honduras that had a coup in 2009, and Clinton was a big supporter of that, our lovely liberal...
Baba?
Look at Panama.
The new Clinton, not the old Clinton.
Panama used to be a hot spot. Now that's one of the more stable places you can go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But
it's just
you're right,
a cycle.
Africa, by the way. That's something that nobody's talking about.
Africa,
it, right?
They didn't reach it yet. It was in Europe.
Oh, they're deep in.
First World War, it was Europe. Second World War, it was sort of Europe and Asia.
Now.
And then you get Asia, and then now it's the Middle East. Now it'll come later, for Africa and South America.
Oh, Africa is
already,
nobody cares. Nobody cares. The biggest Holocaust in the history of humanity is continuing in Africa today. Mm-hmm. And sadly, we are...
quiet.
We, and when I say we, I mean the West, because America is not alone. It's the biggest. It's the chief, obviously. But Europe is, the junior members of the gang. But we're up to our eyeballs in blood in the Congo and Rwanda and other places. So it's not like it's not taking place. Nobody really cares.
It's kind of funny. Africa is going to be, for the economics profession, I think that's going to really be a great piece of subject matter over the next 10 years. Because, one, you do have the current reality, which is a downside to the people living there. But at the same time, it is actually very exciting for the people that aren't directly engaged in warfare.
Yes, sure,
because
sure,
things
sure.
are changing. I read a thing just yesterday about
Nigeria
how
just changed regime peacefully so far, touch wood.
Yeah.
Yesterday.
I read a thing just yesterday. It talked about Amazon's, push to have drone delivery here in the U.S. And the subject of the article is look, that doesn't really change the livelihoods of anyone living in the U.S. or in the developed world. Drone delivery is just a little bit faster. But the bottom line is you still get your thing from Amazon, in a couple hours as opposed
pretty
to a day.
Fast, yeah.
Drones will be huge game changers to the quality of life in Africa. They talked about the abilities to deliver medicines where right now you can, but you don't, because the roads don't exist.
Yeah, you go over the infrastructure, just like cell phones.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You just skip an entire generation of infrastructure, which is a huge cost savings.
Of course, we have to make sure they get over their fear of having having something else delivered.
Well, that's true. I mean, we haven't set a great precedent with drones. You know, right now, if you go pretty much anywhere in the world, like, usually you guys want some drones?
Death from the sky. Yeah. Brought to you.
Yeah.
Right to your home, right to your children, you know. You gotta laugh, right? Because if you stop laughing, you start
There's
crying.
There's also a lot of interesting medical developments, like the very first microfluidics chips, which microfluidics, it's basically, you can take an entire laboratory that you would normally need for diagnostics, you know, normally be a huge building manned by people. Mm-hmm. And they're actually able to etch channels on a silicon chip now. And by controlling, you know, the size of the channel, the viscosity of the fluid, they can process a blood sample on this chip.
Yeah, yeah, right.
It's a technological reality. It's going to be a long time before that makes it into the economy here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Simply because of you have, you know, the tort issues. You have to go through the FDA, and then even then the lawyers still might sue you, and then you've got powerful lobbies, right? Mm-hmm. In Africa, they're going to start, microfluidics chips are going to start to get rolled out in the next couple months.
Wow.
You'll be able, I mean, now.
So you can move the limited medical resources to where they're needed quickly. Yeah.
Now, is Gates supporting that?
You know, I read that. It was a cursory glance. It was late last night as I was trying to compose this really random outline that I have in front of me. What happens is as the week goes on, I'll just copy and paste these random stories into an email. I'll send it off to Balak an hour before the show. But so I didn't take notes.
Hey, don't bother sending them in.
But
bring it on.
But you know, I find that interesting. Is in a way because of the fact they're so far behind the rest of the world, they actually have an opportunity to be ahead of. The
right.
Rest
yeah.
Of the
you
world.
Can.
The entire continent. I mean,
and you got the Chinese.
They
get the Chinese involved there also so much developing infrastructure and you know.
It's a huge continent, so the natural resources are important. And if you go beyond just looking for oil, which I believe another nice little explosion in the Gulf of Mexico, just you know.
What happened?
Like today or something. I saw it on the breaking news. I was kind of busy. And
yeah, I just
saw breaking news. I didn't see the detail. But listen, it happens, you know. I mean, that's the kind of part of the cost, isn't it?
That's an incredibly hostile environment.
Sure, yeah.
I mean, that's just a guarantee. If you drill in deep water, that's going to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
I will say, what the real probably dagger in the heart of the U.S. oil industry is a lot. This is happening in Oklahoma first. Private property owners are going after oil companies for inducing earthquakes that damage their property.
With the fracking.
And these lawsuits are going to end up being, you know what the truth is that it's probably $10,000 in property damage to a home, but the lawyers are going to blow this into.
Right.
That $10,000 is going to become $100,000, and now you multiply that across, you know, 10,000 homes.
Really? You're being optimistic. I mean, consider the BP ended up paying like $600 for shrimping companies that were destroyed. Like, that's going to help.
I'll put this in the context. Oklahoma, for the last century, right, averaged something like 11 earthquakes a year. Mm. And these are small earthquakes. You know, these are the earthquakes that only the seismologists know about, right? Mm. Nobody else really notices anything. A squirrel is like, hey, that nut just fell. They're shaking, right? But in the last 3 years, Oklahoma's averaged something like 6,000 earthquakes a year. And a lot of them are over a magnitude 4.
Wow. No, I'm not contesting the validity of the dangerous.
Oh, you're just saying, you're
I'm
just
saying that once litigation comes, I mean, the record shows that when, you know, BP being an Exxon being very famous, they end up negotiating down to the point where they pay not a tiny fraction of the damage caused.
You know,
Exxon
was very good with that, with the Valdez spill.
Yeah, they really got off the hook. How about BP and the Gulf?
So far, BP, you know, they keep on appealing the decisions. So far in court, they've actually gotten hammered. In fact, the last court ruling, which was about a month ago, the judge ruled that there is no cap on the damages.
So they're getting hammered.
All right,
okay.
That's a good decision. I missed that.
And basically what the judge said was that they were guilty, BP was guilty of gross negligence. I mean, and that's why he assessed that there was no cap on the damages. So far, I mean, granted Exxon has the precedent, but there is a good chance that it could go the other way with BP.
And I wonder where the money ends up. That's one of the issues, right? I mean, to go something completely different, one of the most shocking, right? I think it was Bank of America and several other banks that were found guilty of serious, for illegally foreclosing on houses,
sure, or mortgage fraud,
and they ended up that veterans would come back from the war and find that they've been foreclosed and stuff, and they won their case. And all the Fox Network was all about how, oh my God, those socialists are gunning down our, because they can't say the N-word, yeah? Right. Gunning down our corporate America, communist, blah, blah, blah. But those soldiers come back and they lost their home and their family's living on the street and they get $600
right.
in compensation. So, I mean, by the time, I mean, lawyers probably got pretty fat.
Yeah, that's right.
What
yeah,
I think.
The lawyers,
Because the shrimpers, I mean, what, about 2 years ago when the first, when at least the first ruling for BP, I mean, it ended up that, you know, entire shrimping families were wiped
right.
out.
Yep.
And they ended up getting a couple of $1,000 out of the settlement. Sure, it sounds like a couple of $1 billion, big deal, lots of money. But when you destroy an entire region of America.
But a lot of the problems that they ran into with the whole mortgage thing was with Countrywide, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo was that they were passing on these mortgages left and right, and it got to the point where they didn't even know where the paperwork was.
This is interesting.
No, seriously.
This is really interesting. And here's where this plays in. This was in the New York Times 2 days ago. In many states, there's a statute of limitations on how long a bank can take to foreclose on a piece of property.
Oh, right.
And it's five years. For literally, and then in the New York Times piece, they actually said, we have no idea how many cases this actually applies to. It's at least tens of thousands of homeowners, right? It could be well into the hundreds of thousands.
Do you write off the entire debt outstanding?
Yep. So the way it would work is that these people would go from being foreclosed upon to owning their home free and clear. Now, there is a caveat. The hitch is that the bank can attach a lien on the house, which lasts forever, for the balance of the mortgage. However,
they will have to restructure it.
Well, no. The lien can stay there, but as long as the homeowner doesn't take out another loan, or as long as the homeowner doesn't sell the house,
they
have the house
garnish.
Free and clear. Yeah, they can't garnish, no.
Oh. Interesting. I doubt that'll
well,
fly. You know?
So the first two cases, there's a case in New York and a case in Texas, where in both courts, they basically said the same thing. They basically said, you know, look, as the judges said, we don't like doing this, but we have to stick to the law, and this is what the law says. And that's the legal precedent now.
You know, I wish
there is
they
no
do
contrary
it.
Precedent.
I wish they do it for student loans.
That was taken care of during the Bush administration. Yep. Let's give credit where credit is due, shall we?
I mean, you can't just
my entire progeny is showing up.
File bankruptcy on a student loan.
It's
you
impossible
know?
To. Yeah, you cannot discharge.
Yeah.
Student loans are one form of debt you cannot discharge in bankruptcy. Yeah.
That was plugged in one of the last activities of the Bush administration, making sure that students can be bled.
Yeah, taking care of the bankers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and where
you
know,
what's
start,
interesting,
I mean, you know,
what's interesting about the home foreclosures, though, in a way, you know, the banks in the U.S. now are so well capitalized. They can take
surely.
A big hit on that. Mm-hmm. So in a way, you know, these homes now are actually, in effect, they're permanently off the market. Oh, we've got guests. They're permanently off the market.
Humans, dogs,
cats.
Oh dear!
We've got guests in the studio.
Oh, see, Jesse has house sat our house, so the pets love him and know him well. You know, so they're surrogate daddy. Yeah. Sorry, you know, big kisses and hugs going on in the studio here. I'll just pick up here, you know, for you. Yeah, right. Well, you know, the struggle, it's part of the game, isn't it? I mean, capitalism requires the rule of law and requires the accountability in order to check on, at the best of all possible world, in order to check on powerful entities such as big financial institutions. Insofar as they have to be careful, it can work. The thing is that doesn't seem to be working very well in recent times, that's for sure. Consider, you know, what Jamie Dimon. I love that story because, you know, again, everybody was all about like, oh my God, the biggest fine ever in history. What have they done, those communists? And the guy gets like a massive boost and the stock goes up because essentially Fox Network talk about the government is bleeding our financial institutions. The good banker, Obama's good buddy, the greatest crook in the history of mankind, probably, actually. Probably a safe bet to make for
up
that.
Up there,
no doubt, yeah. Crook, I'm saying. Crook specifically, yeah. Help us out, Phil. She's so excited. Come on.
The oil rig, by the way, was in Mexico.
What?
It's in Mexico. One dead, 16 injured, 300 workers transferred out of the area. It's just caught on camera. I'm running off my iPhone, so it's not, you know.
Yeah, it sells huge this time.
Yeah.
That's good news. But at any rate, once again, you know, so the rhetoric of the corporate media, like Fox, okay, Fox is the worst, but the others are not much better, yeah? Make it as if some kind of, very, you know, the right wingers, if you will, are incensed by how we hurt our poor banksters. And the left is rubbing its hand and feeling good about themselves. But essentially the markets folk, oh my God, they got away with murder again. Right. That's what the markets said, by their reaction to that. So anyway, definitely not hurting in any sense. Yeah. Well, you know what? I want to share with the viewers, we have this thing kind of going on under negotiation, and we're not exactly sure how we do it and what, but a colleague, somebody that I respect for many years, that has a podcast that's syndicated all over America, that's very good, has been a public intellectual for many years, professor, retired, well, emeritus, you know, we professors, we never really retire, we just kind of relax a little bit more until we die. That's how you get rid of us. But and he's doing this podcast. It's quite successful, Economic Update. And I talked with them, and the idea was that potentially at times it's very good. It's very popular. Jesse has warned me that previous times I sent him when I wasn't there a speech, and it was like really boring, and people hated it. And okay, my bad. So let me apologize right now. But, so this is a very popular show. He does little segments, answer, you know, and then he does sometimes longer segments. So I don't exactly know. We are under working on kind of, let's experiment, see how it goes. So we have that. But at the same time, you know, I think Corey has some points. I'd hate to, so maybe, you know, you want to maybe do some of those first, and then we see if we start. My idea is that we play the bits from this 1 hour show, but we'll pay five, you know, each topic. Short ones, at least to start with, and then we can talk about them afterwards and see how that goes.
You know, and
if it's horrible, then let us know and we'll stop it.
And also, while we're doing that too, if you want to call us on your cell phone or whatever it is that you use to communicate, it's 407-646-2915. So,
and we're in the basement, so smoke signals will not work.
Yeah, exactly.
Or telepathy. That would be on level with the technology here.
Oh, yeah.
We need a periscope.
And I need to run out of here because I'm going to go to a job fair, but I'll
That's
be back.
That's why you're dressed like James Bond.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
James Bond job fair.
Yeah, Jesse. I have to confuse the potential employers out there so they can hire me.
Right.
Okay, Cheyenne, it's all yours.
All right, James, taking the table, the DJ. Okay. So, you know, shall we? Let's run with you, and then afterwards
right,
we'll see how
so,
it goes.
I had a couple random points. So the Silk Road case, some of our listeners might be familiar with this. Silk Road was like a Amazon.com for drugs, if you will. They got busted by the FBI about 6 months ago. It came to light just recently that the two lead investigators...
Good luck, break a leg.
For the FBI...
If you're listening, hire him. Hire him. He's a good man. Damn it.
Say hi to Paul.
Sorry about that.
the irony is that I was just about to discuss two corrupt FBI agents, right? Uh-oh. As you said, hire him.
Okay,
no,
sorry,
but there's two FBI agents in this Silk Road case, and it just recently came to light that they literally stole millions in Bitcoin before they actually brought the case.
Oh, Bitcoin.
Before they brought the case to the FBI. So they extorted... They stole millions of bitcoins from, and I was thinking to myself, okay, this is a public servant, and I we shouldn't be naive, we shouldn't have any illusions, but it made me think to myself, maybe it's really not such a great thing that everything in society is about money. I mean, you know, there's no sense of prestige that you had in the ancient world, right?
That's what I was in Chicago all about, right? That's Deirdre's project right now, the third book coming out soon, the bourgeois ethic. The capitalism needs, and she goes back all the way to before, but Adam Smith is key here. The only way the market system can work is particularly important ethics, and those ethics need to be enshrined in a legal system.
Right.
So there is the rule of law thing, which is so big, but also individual, right? This notion, I like to kind of, my shtick on it is like that the powerful banker goes to the gentleman club, you know, in London back in the day when it was working better. And if he don't go there and say, yeah, I just, you know, foreclosed on, you know, soldiers while they're fighting in Iraq and I threw their wives to the street, and everybody, you know, slaps them on the back and tell them, yeah, it's a good man, you know? That was just not fly. If you're going to do stuff like that, you're going to be ashamed of it at the very least.
Right.
And if you get busted, the full force of the law will hit you. So, absolutely, that's necessary for capitalism.
Right. I kind of wonder to a degree. I mean, how do you go about even instilling that in a society? I mean, is that the sort of thing where you need it kind of has to be like a lead by example type of thing from the likes of someone like Gates or?
You know what? I'm reminded. Remember George Carlin?
Sure.
Late comedian.
Yeah.
Said, right?
He was a visionary, but yeah.
Yeah, he had a bit where about the drug wars back in the Reagan years here, and he was talking about how. You know, when they were taking like street drug, you know, crack dealers and lengthening their punishment. So George Carlin would say like, wait a minute, these people, you know, these desperate people have nothing to lose, you know. I mean, they're not scared of jail time necessarily. They're toughened up by their circumstances. He says it's funny, of course.
Right.
But then he kind of goes on and very funny too, talks about, you want to stop the drug flow, why don't you crucify a banker that launders the money?
That's a good point.
So, I was just saying, as part of the move of how to bring maybe a little bit of crucifixion.
It's a very effective
maybe
point,
symbolically
though.
Here, but still.
I feel like about every 6 months I read about some bank, you know, admitting wrong. They admit no wrongdoing, but right. They pay a fine right. Of, you know, 100 million, 50 million, and 500 million, whatever it is
cost
for laundering money.
Business.
It's amazing. I mean,
it's just cheaper.
I guess it shouldn't amaze me, but it amazes me that, you know, let's put it this way. If I was a large shareholder in one of those banks, I would be pissed if I found out my employees were doing that.
Well, I mean,
I think
value of your stock just went up. Again,
yeah.
To go back to, you know, Jamie Dimon gets like busted despite being celebrated. And everybody, I mean, you know, people with straight face say, no, but he's a good one. What? Good by what? Oh, you saw it on Fox? Good for you. He's great. Or MSNBC for that matter. Because he is particularly close to Obama. He has the distinction of being the big banker that's buddies with Obama. While, you know, I think Blank Fine is not so buddies with Obama.
There's a little bit of
the market went up. They got away with the historically biggest fine a bank has ever paid, but it was still ridiculously small compared to the amount that they stole from the American public and individuals. And they got busted, but too big to jail, right? That's the formula. And, but again, once that came through, their stock price went up and he got a massive bonus for having gotten away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're maybe a bit of an anachronism, Corey. You actually have ethics. How very 18th century of you.
Yeah. but it is necessary. It is necessary for society to function, you know, for an economy to function. You need to... There needs to be some sort of a social component to it.
Especially
otherwise,
a relatively free one. That's the thing. I mean, if you have a dictator... of some kind, then you depend on the kindness of your master.
Yeah.
And that has been maybe the norm in most of history, you know? So if you're lucky, you've got a good king or a good master, things are better, and then their son comes along, and he's a sadistic psychopath, and things are bad.
Nero, yeah.
He started very popular, by the way.
He did.
He got migraines or something, right? Man, sometimes I get
out of
we
hand.
All get Nero moments.
You know, out of hand.
We all get Nero moments, you know. The thing is, no, it's Caligula actually. Caligula was the
glass
guy.
He was really.
He was like a spoiled brat. He had issues, yeah, like this thing. But at any rate, but in the long term, actually, okay, I'll jump like all of them. In the long term, the decline of the Roman Republic and the Empire was specifically driven by economic. Inability to maintain a balance again. There's actually quite interesting view of it. You know, look at the fight between the more popular, you know, left maybe, you know, more equal distribution of income movement, the populari as they were called back in Rome, and those who wanted to be like Persia. Damn it. Good enough for them. Why not us? Centralized, you know, everybody's a slave and we are the masters, view. So it was a pushback. The Republic was a different idea and they failed. I mean, you know, in so much as that balance eventually broke. and a little bit that's an interesting parallel. That's often not it's not just overextension of empire and military, which is an old comparison between America and Rome. But especially if you don't look just as, we always focus on the Roman Empire often, but no, look at the Republic, you know, once it went empire, it was already something else. But the failure, and I think it's even more parallel with America, the failure of the Republic to maintain that kind of relative freedom, not run by, you know, accountable government, opportunity relatively, all of that stuff, eventually failed because the powerful got even more power, and ran off with it.
Took over, and
yeah,
it just
so
kept
that's
going.
That's a chronic issue, and it's been kind of focused again in some scholarship, and which is cool because again, it's a lesson. You know, what's wrong with bad distribution of income, right? I mean, you don't want to, you know, allow successful people to be successful is a good motivation, no doubt. But
there has to be a balance.
Yeah.
Because the truth is that no matter if it's one man, one vote, the truth is that money is influence.
Yeah. Or power. Right. Depending what. Power. I mean, you know, in Rome, it would be also how many regions you have.
Right.
Which
yeah.
you had to feed, so it was also money.
Right.
But now it's clearly all about the money. It's not what your family name is anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So long as you have the money. Mostly, right?
So that's why, I mean, like, you know, that's why, like I said, I mean, you have to have some sort of a balance because otherwise you drown out potentially constructive opinions, potentially constructive ideas. Since we're talking about drowning out potentially constructive ideas, any thoughts on 2016 yet? And the reason I bring this up is I've kind of followed the junk, if you will, with Hillary.
Oh.
I really wonder if the Democrats will field her.
Really? I mean, like a month ago, she was like the next president. Clinton the second.
Yeah. I say almost.
I really, you know what I'm rooting for? I think it doesn't matter, frankly.
Oh, yeah, I agree.
What I'm rooting for is Clinton versus Bush. I just think it's really funny. Clinton 2 versus Bush 3. It's just hysterical. Yeah, tell me again about democracy.
That would be such a great poster.
It would be so funny,
Clinton
you know?
2 versus
so
Bush
funny.
3.
It would be funny if it wasn't so terrible. You know, it would start destroying this country, but that's another matter, of course. But and then, you know, my Bada Meinhof shtick that, in fact, you know, I'm more probably in, well, I don't know, I'm not left, you know, I'm, you know, Sendero-Kanakis, we're a mix of red and black, you know, we bridge both extremes in some ways. In some ways, I'm a left libertarian, actually. I recently found out that that's a term in American.
Okay.
It's an American term. Huh. The original European is Sendero-Kanakis, but left libertarian. So you want minimal government, but you realize that power needs to be contained and opportunity needs to be actively fostered. That's what socialists used to be before they screwed it up in the early 20th century. You know, that was the ideal. And maybe difficult to accomplish. Though the person that eventually we might actually play a little of his stuff later, he's a big advocate for market socialism, for democracy at work, owner-directed, owner-managed companies, because it's much better for the incentives. So it's not from a point of view. And in fact, when I sat with all these libertarians and big right-wing thinkers in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, that's something that, again, there's a pretty strong acceptance that that's a great way of producing, after all. The notion of the detached board with different incentives than the long-term benefit of the company or certainly the community within which the company is located is really, it's not good unless you go back to this pre-capitalist view of the world where I'm master and it's good for me. And
right,
that's
yeah, exactly. Those Taleb's notions, sleep under your own bridge. Did you see the Monsanto interview from a few days ago?
Oh, wow, with a drink it?
Yeah.
That was funny.
He's like, oh, sure, I'd love to drink it. So
drink it. What do you think?
Where was that? Was that in Brazil?
No, in France, actually.
It was in France, that's right, yeah.
Absolutely.
The Monsanto executive, he came out and he said, I forget how the interview started, but the Monsanto executive ended up saying, well, you could drink up to a liter of, what was it, Roundup.
Yeah.
He said, it wouldn't hurt you. He said, people try to commit suicide all the time, which I thought was a really weird thing to say. People try to commit suicide all the time by drinking it and they always fail. And I just thought to myself, man, what a weird thing to say.
And it's so anecdotal too. It's just like those climate deniers that say, oh, look, it was snowing a lot this year, so there must not be climate change. I mean, let's go beyond preschool level if you don't, if you're even capable of.
The reporter comes back on. The reporter comes back on. And he says, "Well, actually, we have some Roundup here in the studio. If you'd like to drink it,
have a shot."
The guy says, "I'd love to." And he says, "Well, I'll go get it." And the guy says, "I'm not stupid. I'm not going to drink Roundup."
I know. That was right. So
that was wonderful. And then the executive from Monsanto just walked off the set.
Oh yeah, and then he got all huffy and puffy, right? Yeah. Because that's
he wanted to talk about golden rice or something like that. And,
yeah, the talking points, didn't he?
Yeah.
He had to go over his marketing material. Yeah, that was funny.
The other points I have are all, I don't know, they're kind of random. One thing I'm starting to follow, and we'll probably touch on this in the future, is biohacking. Biohacking is a very interesting field. So there is recently, I want to say, it wasn't at MIT, it was at a polytech school up in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows who volunteers for this, but not only did he work on the project, but he volunteered. He had a chemical substance put into one of his eyes. And it gave him night vision for like 4 hours. And when we to test his night vision, they took him into a dark forest along with control subjects with normal vision. And when I say dark forest, like pitch
really
black,
dark, yeah.
The control subjects couldn't see trees 6 feet from them.
Yeah.
This guy was able to identify people 150 feet away.
Like a cat. Cat vision or whatever. Right.
So, I mean, and that's just one. And then, you know, by morning, the chemical had worn off and his vision was back to normal.
And we don't get the reports about all the guys that became blind screaming, you get the horror movie scene.
Actually, this guy actually worked on the project. So that's talking about a lot of confidence is when you want to put it in your own eye. But, I mean, there's also a guy at MIT. He's trying to implant a chip into his brain to augment his memory.
Mm.
That's cool. I want that.
It's all the stuff. The cyberpunk literature I read in the 80s is coming true. That's how I'll do that, man. I mean, it's my birthday. I'm ready to be
happy birthday.
Aquarium. I want to be like a floating brain with wires, and I was supposed to already be
Right.
But it's an interesting field. We'll definitely touch on it more in the future because it does have some rather significant implications, especially when it comes to, equality of opportunity. I mean, so just as a hypothetical to blow it out of proportion, you take someone like Elon Musk, right, who's already fairly wealthy. Well, all of a sudden, now he's going to live to be 200. He's going to accumulate capital for 200 years, right? Mm-hmm. He takes something else that augments his ability to think creatively, something else that augments his ability, to remember things. And next thing you know, I mean, there's such a divide between him and...
We'll speciate. Essentially. I mean, Bruce Sterling, actually, author from the 80s, I think he's dead, or he's not writing anymore. I'm sorry if he's alive. Don't mean, I'm a bit of a fan. Sorry about that. Sorry about that.
He hasn't written a while.
I'll assume dead. Missing. But he had a whole series of stories how sometimes they write in the world several novellas and stories where humanity basically split into those who are bio-enhanced and those who are mechanically enhanced. And that essentially became completely a wonderful series of books, completely two kinds. And he wrote Holy Fire. I used to give students sometimes in humanities and things because it's exactly there. And we're talking like a book written in 86 or something like that, right? And precisely, if you're wealthy, it's the biotech boom, right? He's writing it just as the beginning of the tech boom and computers coming. He's like, what's the next wave? It's biotechnology. Once we're done with the digital bio. So if you're wealthy, it's probably because you're investing in biotech companies. And those biotech companies are primarily working on enhancing humanity, lifespan, abilities, etc. If you invest well and your company comes up with good technology, then not only are you even wealthier now, but you are also implementing that technology in your body.
Yeah.
So you get this geriatocracy of primarily old women, highly enhanced, extremely wealthy, and literally it's socially speciation. All the young people are stuck in the mud. They use cash. They don't have bank accounts. You need $1 million to have a bank account, Otherwise you just use debit cards,
It's interesting.
And you can't even go to places without that. So it's all these enhanced, wonderfully operated, plastified old rich people who become a completely different society. And I used to love it because, of course, the young people eventually, the protagonist is like 95 or something. She does the most radical technology thing. And now she's like 23, super augmented. It's all like cyberpunk, so it's kind of, hardcore.
You know what's amazing is, though, it's just, a word you used there was enhancement, right? Mm-hmm. One of the reasons we actually haven't seen this yet is because of right now, if you're going to submit a medication or a treatment or a device to the FDA, it has to be to remedy a disease, right? You can't submit something to the FDA to enhance. And there's actually, because of some of these very large pharmaceutical companies, there isn't really a potential for them to have blockbuster, the so-called blockbuster drugs. They're running out of those drugs, those big money makers. A lot of the big pharmaceutical companies, they see human enhancement as the next wave. And the FDA is supposed to visit that this year as to whether or not they will allow companies to submit drugs, treatments, devices that enhance human abilities.
Though I got to say, this is really risky because I can tell you that I doubt that my health insurance would cover it. And then, you know, to hell with it, you know?
Maybe Obamacare will cover it.
Yeah, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Well, the discussion with, I hate to say it, but the discussion with enhancements, it basically, it comes down, that's, war is one thing. Mm-hmm. DARPA is seen as a customer, and DARPA already has a lot of human enhancement projects. I mean, they're way out on the curve on this. And there's a discussion of basically having a product that you cater to the very wealthy, because I saw it in The Economist, and it was a rather objective piece, and it basically said, look, you have a good sized population of very wealthy people in the world, but there's only so much stuff you can sell them, right? You know, how many planes do they need? How many boats do they need? You know, if you're going to sell them a car. Yeah, that's actually really, even if you're selling them really expensive cars, it's not a terribly profitable venture.
Right.
But now if you're talking about something that could delay their aging, sell it for $1 million, you know, once every 10. Yeah, yeah, I mean, and they'll pay. Right. So there's, I mean, you know, there's a profit incentive there.
But this is really, I mean, you know, Mary Shelley wrote a book about it in 1880-something called Frankenstein, by the way. And I'd like to see the whole anti-abortion crowd, what they have to say about this stuff. In terms of messing with creation, and then the class thing. I mean, how would that would accelerate the inequality?
That's right.
Already, you know, the kids, rich kid can go to good schools.
We're already doing it.
Mm-hmm. Well, to a point, of course, to a point, but this would accelerate.
You're throwing rocket fuel on it.
How do you get back to balance? We talked about getting back to balance. This will make it much harder.
Right.
To get back to balance. Yeah, it's top of the hour, so let's do this thing.
Okay.
The preceding program did not reflect the views or opinions of the station, its management, or employees.
This program is coming to you via Relay 2 satellite, a spacecraft orbiting the Earth at a speed of over 17,000 miles per hour. The musical selections you're about to hear were first tape recorded and fed into a transmitter where they were beamed to Relay 2 spacecraft. As you listen to the musical selections, note the clarity and excellent stereophonic separation between the left and right channels, even after traversing 12,000 miles in space.
WPRK 91.5
media lies.